This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Our guest today will be Les Leopold. He's been on the show before, and I think a long time ago he was on one of my other shows, probably the Holistic Survival Show a few years back. But he's got some interesting things to say about things that interest us as an investor, so we'll get to that here in just a bit. But we have five things to cover first, and I've got Steve here, our investment counselor, who you've heard on the show many, many times. And we've got a few things to talk about that you'll find not only interesting and valuable, but also a little bit funny too. Steve, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Five things to talk about with you and I means a long intro, probably.
You know, we've never been known for being short-winded, have we?
No.
Yeah, so let's jump into it. What's first?
Well, I want to hear about this trip to Europe. Are you all sophisticated and European now?
You know what? I wouldn't call European that sophisticated, honestly. It's funny how Americans idealize Europe, and I always have too. And I remember my first trip back there. I was born in Europe, but my first trip back as an adult, I went with a friend of mine who was also impressed with Europe. And so some people are so impressed with Europe. And looking at it this time, I mean, I've been back many times and I love to visit Europe, but as an economist, I am completely unimpressed with Europe. I mean, I just got to say. And you know, of course, every country is different and every city and every country is different too. But just generally on my impression this time between Switzerland, Germany, Austria, Croatia, Montenegro, Spain, and Iceland, I remain unimpressed. And I got to tell you something very funny that happened. I didn't mention this as I talked to Brittany on our last episode about my Europe trip. And Steve, you're going to love this one. You ready?
Yeah.
And the listeners are going to love this too. Now, just so you know, this is purely what she said. I did not go online to research this and verify the information and whether or not these tax rates were true and correct, but it's just what the girl told me. So here it is. When you're in, many countries do this. They have a VAT or a value-added tax, and you pay it when you buy a retail item there. And when you leave and take that item out of the country, you can get a refund for part of the tax that you pay. And so I never get to an airport early because I have yet to see in all of my travels now to 69 countries, and some countries many times. I've been everywhere. I've been a lot of places, not everywhere, but a lot of places. I have yet to see a plane leave early.
Right.
You know, it's always the game of, they have a saying in Hollywood, if you're an aspiring actor or actress, when you go to do these auditions, the game is hurry up and wait. So you go and then you got to be there on time, of course, and then you wait 2 or 3 hours to get your turn to say three lines to hope that you'll get the part, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It's a hugely inefficient process.
So. But they're not going to go, hey, looks like everybody's here, let's shut the door and leave.
Yeah, you know? No, exactly. So it's the game of hurry up and wait, which is the same game the airline industry plays on us. So this was one of the rare occasions where I actually arrived at the airport early and I had all this extra time. So I thought, you know what? I remember I bought in Iceland, you know, the whole trip was too hot, too warm. But when I got to Iceland, it was such a relief to have cool, crisp weather. And I was actually a little chilly. So I bought a thing to go around my neck. And I don't know what it's called. It's kind of a funny thing. You can put it around your head and around your neck. And, you know, it's a more inventive version of the old concept of a scarf or a muffler, right? Anyway, right. It was kind of a cool product that they said everybody really liked. And so I bought one of those. And I don't buy much because I like to carry my luggage on. That's the other thing I've learned from all my travels.
And you can pack luggage like, you know, circus clowns into a car.
I am an expert packer.
Yeah, you are the champion of the world.
Another lesson I've learned, I pack light and travel light and pack well. So, you know, you can go online and there's all kinds of YouTube videos on how to pack properly. There is a definite art and science to that.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
But anyway, so I don't buy much, and because I don't want to be checking bags traveling back. So I buy this thing, and I don't know, it's like everything's so overpriced in Europe. It's probably $50 or something like that, and by the time you convert it to dollars. But I was told it was worth it, so I bought it. And she gave me this little envelope and this slip and says, you know, when you go to the airport, you can get some of your tax back. And I'm like, are you kidding? I'm not going to bother with this, right? But I had some extra time, and I thought, hey, I'll learn something about how this works. I've never bothered to get my money back on anything I've purchased offshore before. And so I go to the counter, and the cutish 20-something girl behind the counter says, you know, how do you want your refund back? You know, we can put it on your credit card or give you cash or whatever. And I'm like, I'll take it on the credit card. I'm not going to spend any more money. And when I said, by the way, you know, how much do I get back? And she says, I think she said, you get 15% back. And I said, oh, really? Wow. Is that the amount of your sales tax here? And she goes, no, sales tax is 25%. And I go, 20? Are you kidding me? Your sales tax is 25%? And she goes, yeah. And I go, well, you must not have income tax then in Iceland, or it must be really low, right? And she goes, no, income tax is 40%. And as my mouth was open and my jaw was dropping to the floor, and the other two girls in the booth there next to her were all kind of jumping in the conversation, I go, so wait a sec, you pay 40% in income tax and you pay 25% in sales tax. You got to be kidding me. And she says, no, but we have free healthcare. Oh my God. You must be kidding me.
Oh, it's free. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know what's funny, Steve? I have had countless discussions and debates with taxi drivers in England over the years. I mean, I've been to England many times, right? Love England. Yeah, great place. And awesome history, awesome place to visit. I can't say the food's super great or anything, but it, you know, nobody can. The Brits are not known for their food, but you know, they're known for fashion. They got good styles there. I mean, Italy is too, of course, but and France. But you know, England's a great place. Love going to England. But every time, invariably, when I get in a conversation with a taxi driver, especially in London, it always goes into, how are things in America? How things in England? Because we used to be joined there, and now we're not. and the problem with America, they always say, is if you get sick, you're going to go bankrupt. And it's like, oh my God, what is with the European mentality? What is the big deal about this healthcare thing?
They'd rather be bankrupt all the time.
I think they'd rather be sick. You know, I just think there's this like culture of sickness there. Like everybody's so worried about getting sick all the time. Hopefully being sick is the last thing you have to think about in your life, right?
Well, you can take some responsibility. Granted, there are things, injury and illnesses that are just going to happen. But a lot of these things, if you just used your brain for 10 seconds every day, you're not going to have to worry about it.
It's like eat right, get some exercise, you know, some obvious stuff. But
they have a different perspective. You know, I was at a workshop in Boston once, and executives had come in from all around the world to attend this workshop. And I was sitting next to a British fellow at lunch, and he had arrived a couple days early.
By the way, you know, I got to interrupt you. Yeah. You know what we forgot to mention that England has the best of any place in the world?
What's that?
The frickin' accents.
Yeah, they do.
I love the way they talk. I mean, just let me hear a British person. I just love it.
I know. Everything they say has more credibility.
It's just so classy. I mean, they got that. Yeah, it's awesome. Okay, go ahead.
Right.
You're in Boston. Tell me more.
So I'm in Boston sitting next to this British guy at lunch. And he tells me that he got to Boston a couple of days early. And I said, well, what have you been doing? And he said, well, I just took a tour of all the revolutionary sites. I wanted to see what went wrong.
You know what went wrong? It's the same thing that's going wrong with America today. It's called taxation without representation.
I know his point of view is, wow, they sure got riled up and made their own country. What was the big fuss all
about?
Yeah,
maybe we need to do that again, because we're certainly not being represented anymore.
Yeah, something's wrong.
Yeah, something is definitely wrong. That's funny. That's funny. All right. Well, enough of the Europe thing. But, well, one more thing on that is, I'm going to talk on my Jet Setter show. I'm going to have him on as a guest. The potential local market specialist in the southern part of Spain that you referred to me, Steve. And tell the listeners, if you would, what you know about that. And when I said I'm going to Europe and I asked you, do you have any contacts? I always want to look at real estate in all these places I go, and I always do it faithfully because I'm addicted to what I do. I absolutely love this stuff. But you instantly knew that Marbella was like their Miami, right?
Yeah. I had known this developer, a British guy, actually, who had been living in Spain, and we'd been talking for quite a while. And he told me about how he had to wind down his developing and how almost everybody had to, because Marbella was going through, you know, what Miami or what Las Vegas had been through. It was ground zero of their crisis over there. So much building, so much happening. And I, of course, perked right up, saying, oh, new properties in a nice area. I wonder how good this can really be. I didn't do a ton of research into it beyond that. I just sent you over there to do it.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, that place, it's gorgeous. I mean, I was so impressed. And it's that old thing of like the how our mind plays tricks on us with comparisons. I always try to overcome that and remember it, because we got to try and not be too swayed by things that might mislead us, whether it be our emotions or our perceptions. And you know, it's like the old trick that traditional realtors have. Show them the ugliest house first, and then show them an okay house, and then show them the nicest one last. Like the traditional realtor showing a home buyer around in the city in which they live. That's sort of a trick that's been used in real estate, because it, by comparison, things look better, right? You know, the first house the buyer gets to, they think, is this all I can get for my, if you're in Orange County, my $600,000?
Yeah,
or maybe
right.
A million. And then they show them a better one, and then the last one is the best one. And I went from Barcelona, which I'm telling you, I was so disappointed. I'd been to Barcelona before, and God, it felt like the Detroit of Europe, man. I mean, that place was not clean. I mean, granted, old European cities are known for, you know, listen, I'm not new at this, okay? I've been to almost everywhere in Europe. And, you know, they're not known for being super clean, but there's like graffiti everywhere. And it just felt like desperation in the air. Like nobody's got a job. And you know, you look at the stats, and nobody has a job.
I mean, bored, unemployed young people equals graffiti, doesn't it?
Well, it equals crime and a lot of other problems.
Yeah, it's a problem, and nobody can afford to hire anybody because of all the free healthcare.
Yeah.
It's free, though.
it's free. Socialism, you know, we're seeing socialism collapse. I mean, we've been seeing it collapse for decades. You know, I remember in the front of, I think it was Time magazine, you know, someone can probably look this up on Google, maybe in 1990, you know, like 23 years ago, or 1993, about 20 years ago, the front of it said the end of the welfare state. It was on the cover of Time, you know, a liberal publication.
Was it an April 1st edition of...
April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
Our listeners finally learned what that was when I announced my retirement, remember?
Yeah, after I had to explain for like 2 weeks to people that was a spoof. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, that was a hassle. But but it was kind of funny to play a trick on the listeners.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it just doesn't work, folks. When are we going to get a clue here?
Yeah, my dad and I were joking yesterday because we had some neighbors that had to move back to Brisbane, Australia. Some people that we know pretty well, and they were not happy about it, actually. It's a long story. But we started joking that in these countries with socialized medicine, they have to have the attrition factor because, you know, you schedule a guy for an emergency appendectomy in 6 months, but half of them will be dead before then. So you could actually get a cancellation by default if you wanted to get your surgery that was scheduled that far out.
Listen, it's part of the business plan to have people die waiting in line. I mean,
Yeah, I know.
that's exactly what happens in England. It happens in Canada, probably to a lesser degree, but England's worse about it.
Jason, it's free though.
Yeah, well, hey, if you want to see healthcare get really expensive, just make it free. So there you go.
Well, a dog left something on my front lawn for free this morning.
There you go. Well, yeah, I hope you picked it up by now, or maybe Obama's men will come and pick it up.
Yeah, I'll have to tell him.
Hey, but another thing that's kind of part of socialism in the United States, I mean, listen, U.S. isn't immune to this. We're a disaster, too, in so many ways. And that's the fact, although we benefit from it and have benefited from it as investors. But like I always say, real estate in America has been subsidized since the Great Depression. And there's another sign that this may be coming to an end. And if it does, most investors think that'll be the end of the world. I think it'll be the beginning of a brave, new, wonderful world. I don't want to say brave new world because that wasn't a good world he depicted in Huxley's vision of a brave new world. But in this case, it actually would be a good world as long as investors adapt their thinking and they know how to play the game. Because remember, income property is a multidimensional asset class. And as such, you can always profit in a different dimension. So you can be at a certain phase in the market, you can be a capital gains investor, and you can make big profits and big gains by being more speculative in your philosophy and in your technique. And in other parts of the market, you can be a cash flow or an income investor, or like an annuity investor or a bond investor, but much better than either of those. And in other parts of the market, you can invest for diversification and asset protection and income tax benefits. And it's just so multidimensional. In other parts of the market, you can invest for sweat equity and adding value through creativity. There are so many wonderful options. But one thing that we see, if we see some of the real estate socialism end, ultimately, I think it could be a very good thing for those who already own property and have positioned themselves in advance for this, probably I could say with confidence, eventuality, because it's going to happen. It has to happen eventually because the math simply doesn't work. Now, when it's going to happen, I don't know, Steve, but what is your take on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Well, there was a story this week because there's been some noise in Congress and in the Senate about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In fact, I have a quiz for you and the listeners, Jason. Are you ready?
You're putting me on the spot again.
You're going to do okay with this.
You've done this to me before. You really can't make the host look stupid in front of his listeners, but okay, go ahead.
And you folks, don't need me to do that.
And thank you. You know, I'll get you for that one.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I hope I get this right because we're just going to say we're not going to edit this, but go ahead. Give me the quiz.
Okay. Here is a recent quote from this USA Today story. And this, the person quoting this is referring to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. For too long, these companies were allowed to make huge profits buying mortgages, knowing that if their bets went bad, taxpayers would be left holding the bag. It was heads we win, tails you lose, and it was wrong. Who said this? A. Rush Limbaugh. B. George W. Bush. C. Mitch McConnell. Or D. Barack Obama.
Okay, so the question was awfully long there. It's basically saying that this can't work because taxpayers will be left holding the bag. Do you want to just repeat that a little bit?
Yeah, basically for too long, these companies are allowed to make huge profits, you know, knowing that if their bets went bad, the taxpayers would be left on the hook.
I'm going to say that's Rush Limbaugh. You wouldn't hear that from George W. Bush, although you should hear it from George W. Bush.
Yeah, well, a lot of people think you would, but yeah, you probably would not hear it from him. Well, I regret to inform you that you have been made to look stupid on the show because,
oh.
I mean, duh, this was Barack Obama, the freewheeling capitalist.
Oh, give
that we
me
all know
a break. You got to be kidding me.
I'm not kidding you. Those words came out of Barack Obama's mouth.
Well,
it was not on April Fool's.
Well, then that just goes to show you what a hypocrite Barack Obama is.
Yeah,
that guy, absolutely. That guy, you know what? I should have known you were setting me up for that one because that guy, his words almost never match his actions. That's how he's fooled so many people.
Oh, I know. Did he put down his copy of Atlas Shrugged and then walked out to the podium and ripped off that quote?
Yeah, probably. That's just absurd. I mean, he did not. You should have asked me who would have meant it not who said it. Hey, I got a question for you. How do you know a politician is lying, Steve?
I'm going to go with his lips are moving.
Yeah, well, you got that one right. It's too damn easy. Okay, go ahead. You got another one?
Well, that was the quiz, so you failed miserably.
Oh, God, I don't even get a second chance.
No, but, you know, it was definitely a setup. You know, there's a bill introduced in the House of Representatives right now to eliminate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know, the House of Representatives is Republican-controlled. I personally don't think very many of them really want to do this. They just want to look tough to their constituents before the midterms. But then the Senate, who, you know, it's narrowly Democrat, just barely right now, has introduced a bill that's going to wind them down. It won't eliminate them completely. I'm calling bull on the whole thing. I think they're all trying to look like they're doing something. But I don't remember when government has voluntarily shrunk itself in the last 50 years. And before anybody says, well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are private companies, come on. If you really think that, get on a flight to England, make an appointment for 13 months from now so you can get an MRI and have your head examined. We all know that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are quasi-private companies at best. And, you know, it would certainly, if they went away, there would be some ramifications in the housing market. You know, it would probably make rates go up. It would probably make prices go up. Because remember, the housing market has been artificially inflated all this time. And that's what we talk about on the show is there's nothing that you can do as an investor about it being artificially inflated. Only thing you can do is take advantage of it. So you might as well.
Well, that's an interesting language you're using. What do you mean by artificially inflated? Let's drill down on that for just a second.
I read a book, and I would recommend this to all the readers. And I think you've had Dr. Thomas Sowell on the show.
Oh,
you?
Yeah. He's awesome. Love
yeah.
Him.
He wrote a book called The Housing Boom and Bust.
Yep. And I had him on the show to talk about that exact
yeah.
book. Yeah.
And it is the best, most comprehensive. Well, that and also Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short.
Yeah, that's great too. Yeah. We haven't been able to get Michael Lewis on the show. I think he's too famous.
Yeah, he's too good for us. But we're working on it. Maybe we'll scale up the ladder.
Hey, come on! We've had three presidential candidates on the show. Big candidates, not small ones. Like people that could have won. Okay,
that's true. Hey, we had Meredith Whitney. She's no slouch either.
Yeah, well, we got all kinds of famous people. But anyway, go ahead. Hey, we've got Steve and Jason on the show.
That's right. That's right. Hey, Michael Lewis, who do you think you are? Get on the show.
This is going to be in the transcript, and you know he's probably got a Google alert set up for his name, and he's going to see that.
So. We love your books, Michael. We'd love to have you on the show.
Yes, we want to hear more about The Big Short. But okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
So what I mean by it is, and this is how I perceive it, and you know, listeners, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but much of the housing crisis I think rooted back into the '90s when there was a lot of pressure on banks to make loans to people that, there's no other way to say it, really shouldn't have been getting loans, making homes more affordable, so to speak. Well, that's not what the market would bear. And so you have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that are guaranteeing these loans. People originate them. Fannie Mae buys them, packages them, and sells them. And they're guaranteeing this. And so, of course, Wall Street's going to go bananas. I mean, you throw a big steak into a cage full of tigers and you get mad at the tigers for eating it. We all know what Wall Street is. They've always been greedy. Don't say that they're just more greedy now. But when Fannie Mae and tacitly the government is on the back end of this thing guaranteeing all of these mortgages, that's why this has been artificially pumped up, in my opinion, is if the true market was dictating what the terms would be, a lot of these people would have never have purchased houses. We never would have had a boom, nor would we ever have had a bust.
Right. True. The market would have been much more stable. And that's the same issue with the money supply. If we had sound money, in other words, it was attached to something and not just complete fiat, back when we were on the gold standard before 1971, or even could even be done, because I'm not a big proponent of the gold standard, by the way. Just let me put that on the record. And you know I'm not a big proponent of gold either, okay?
I do not. I've heard. Yeah,
and hey, Jason Hartman was right again. Look at what gold's been doing, right? So there you go. And even if it was going up, it wouldn't matter because there's still so many other issues. Is the gold going up or the dollar going down? You've heard me talk about that ad nauseum.
Right.
But even if it could even be done by a formula like Bitcoin, we could even have fiat currency so long as there was a hard formula. It could be fiat. It could be just currency, not money. If it had an actual formula that limited its supply and made it intentionally scarce and then made it impossible to debase the currency. But, you know, in our world today, the politicians would, they'd ruin it.
Find a way to screw that up. Yeah, yeah, I'm skeptical about Bitcoin. The first time I heard about it, you were about 10 feet away from me talking to somebody. We were at an expo in Nashville. And these people at this expo, well, they were survivalists. Nothing wrong with that. But some of them were just, wow, okay.
Yeah, they're out there. They're nuts, yeah.
This guy with no teeth who had clearly knocked back a whole jug of moonshine right before he came to the show, he was the first person to inform me about Bitcoin. So I did not have the best first impression.
Hey, don't shoot the messenger. Bitcoin's okay. But I don't know. You know, the problem with Bitcoin is that the regulators are going to shut it down. They're going to find a way. There's way too much risk. Think about it. Anything that is in competition with the fake money produced by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department is going to be under attack because that's their competitor. They don't want alternative currencies. Why do you think they have legal tender laws that say, it says it right on your dollar bill. It says, for all debts, public and private. You cannot open, if you open a business and you put a restaurant on the corner, Steve, and you say, look, we don't accept dollars, we only accept gold coins or silver coins, you're going to be hauled off to jail. That's illegal. You're going to go to prison.
Right.
So you have to. You are forced to accept dollars.
Yep. You have to do it. You don't want to go toe-to-toe with somebody who can create money out of thin air.
Yeah, or create, you know, or has the power to inflict violence on you and imprison you, and that's called the government. Which the government needs that power, okay? There should be the only entity that has it, but it's a whole other discussion. Ayn Rand, okay? Anyway, so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The reason I look at, if Fannie and Freddie are put out to pasture, what is that going to mean to investors? It's going to mean probably lower real estate prices, but probably much higher rents. Because think about it, people only have three choices. They can buy, they can rent, they can be homeless. So given those three choices in a marketplace, then what are they going to do? Well, if buying gets a lot harder, then that will create more renters. And if there are more renters, the most fundamental rule of economics is what? It's supply and demand. So when you have constrained supply, which you'll always have when it comes to housing for so many reasons that we've discussed before, then you will see increase in rental rates, probably a dramatic increase. Now, here's the other thing, Steve. You said that the existence of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac artificially inflated real estate prices. And I agree with you that that's true in cycles. And certainly in the last financial crisis, that was a cycle. And it was true in cyclical markets, in the bubble markets, California, New York, high-priced markets, okay, Miami, etc. But in the linear markets, that bubble was far less pronounced because those prices, they went up, there was some upward pressure on them, but it wasn't anything major. So the fall that they took wasn't that significant either, right?
Right.
But I don't really know, and I don't think anybody knows. I think this is maybe impossible to really know. But I would assert that the true prices of real estate in linear markets, the markets we recommend around the country, is actually not inflated even now, even in, say, Phoenix, which is one of the more inflated markets that we would still, on the fringes, recommend. I mean, we'd never recommend overinflated markets in California or New York City or those types of places, okay? But like we would say Phoenix is too high. We're really not that interested in it right now because it's gone up too much. But that's nothing compared to some of the really high-priced markets. But if you look at markets like the various cities in Texas, whether they be Austin, Dallas, San Marcos, Houston, San Antonio, or you look at Indianapolis, where you used to live, and we've done mountains of business there, or many other markets around the country that we recommend, I'm not really sure prices are overinflated there, even if Fannie and Freddie went out of business. Now, if they went out of business tomorrow, we'd probably see prices initially soften in those markets, maybe 10%, which is not that big a deal. So your $120,000 house goes to 108, so what? No big deal. And the reason I say this is because when you look at real estate around the world, and especially having just returned from Europe, I mean, their housing stock is so much more expensive than ours. Even in less desirable locations of less desirable cities, I mean, you try to buy real estate around the world, you look at Panama, Costa Rica, Argentina, all markets I've looked in extensively, all over Europe, give me any city or country in Europe, and it's expensive. So I'm not sure that our real estate is really that expensive in linear, non-bubble type markets. Your thoughts? We've never, by the way, listeners, Steve and I have never discussed this issue before.
That's true. I agree with you, Jason, because you can look. I've pulled the data from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA.gov. I'm a little bit of a geek. I like to take their housing price index and put it into spreadsheets and make graphs out of it. How nerdy is that?
You're more than a little bit of a geek, but go ahead.
Yeah. That was your revenge from my earlier comment.
Yeah, it was. But being a geek is a freaking compliment nowadays.
it kind of is. Yeah, they do rule the world.
Do you remember that movie, Revenge of the Nerds?
Yeah.
That has become so, that was a prediction. I mean, you know, with Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and all the rest, I mean, they run the world.
That was. And so now I put these into a spreadsheet and maybe I'm a little bit cool for it. I don't know. But you look at the linear markets and I could not make the argument that Fannie and Freddie have artificially inflated those, because look at the chart. It doesn't inflate. I mean, it goes very steadily.
The problem is that Fannie and Freddie have been around for so many decades that it's really hard to tell. But I mean, I'll just tell you, in any country that I've looked at around the world that's semi-desirable as a place to potentially invest, you got to convert it, because they all measure in square meters, which there's about 10 square feet to a meter. So if they say you've got a 150 square meter flat, that's about 1500 square feet, give or take. You're going to pay 200 to 200 by the time you do the currency conversion and the size conversion, you're going to pay about $200 to $250 per square foot, if not a heck of a lot more. Whereas in these markets that we recommend, I mean, look, we're going to talk about two properties today, Steve. We're going to talk about a highly desirable city. We're going to talk about an Austin suburb. And let me just look here, $64 a square foot. Another one, $48 a square foot. You couldn't touch stuff like that in any of these other cities around the world. And they don't have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They don't have good mortgage financing in most of these countries at all, if anything. So this is why I can't make it work internationally. I've beat my head against the wall to try and make something work offshore out of the country. And you go to Nicaragua, for God's sake. How many would put Nicaragua at the top of their list? Probably very few people, okay? It's not cheap there either.
The financing is horrible. So yeah, I mean, the availability of it, I mean, has it brought prices down? But I don't know, because they don't have Fannie Mae in Europe, as you say. But kind of what we're going off of here is what you said, is it enables these bubbles, it enables these cycles, because the speculators, they don't have to take any responsibility. If they were the one on the hook at the end of the day, you can bet that they would adjust their terms, and that there's a lot of these loans that they would have never have made in the first place. So I think that under the guise of making homeownership affordable and making it more available, I mean, I think that that it's created more heartache and more problems.
Oh, ultimately it has. Listen, I'm not in favor of any government program, but I'm just saying, as investors, let's take advantage of it. If we can make it work for us, hey, let's be opportunistic and do that. But the point being, what does this mean if you're listening? This means that if you can get a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan now, you better get one. And you better get as many of those as you can. You can probably get 10 of them, and you can buy 10 houses. And if those go away, it's probably going to put really good upward pressure on your rental income, which is going to be great for you if people can't afford to buy. And later, of course, the private market will come in and try to fill the gap. But I doubt that it will ever be as good as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lose billions and billions of dollars. They're subsidized by the government. They're illogical. Private businesses aren't going to be illogical like that. They're going to require that they have working, sound economic models or at least semi-sound. I'm not going to say every private business has a sound economic model, but they're not going to last for very long. I mean, there will be other financing sources. There are today, but they're not going to be as good as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, this is a way to get some of your tax money back, is to go get a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan. It's a government program that even the rich can qualify for. So
that's right. Even those evil rich people.
Yeah, even those evil capitalists.
Yeah. And Fannie and Freddie have actually turned a profit the last couple of years, but that's misleading because it's all going right back into their payoff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a side point, but it's going to pay off their bailout that they got. So I guess they're okay for now. We should take advantage of them as investors, but I need to go on the record here. I think Barack Obama is more likely to shut down the Marine Corps than he is Fannie Mae.
Fair enough. You're probably right about that. Okay. Hey, we got to wrap up. Of course, we're going so long here. Let's talk about Russia real quick, because this is hilarious.
this one's funny.
This is just a funny story. It doesn't have that much to do with real estate, but
will
Steve.
Will Detroit try this?
Yeah. Maybe Detroit can do this and that'll save Detroit. Yeah, right. Tell us about it.
Oh, there we got a headline here. To boost economy, Russia frees jailed entrepreneurs.
So what they're doing, it's a Newser article, says, faced with economic malaise, Russia needs some more entrepreneurs, and it knows just where to find them: in prison. The Putin administration official has made it his mission to scour the prison camp system, once known as the Gulag, for businessmen that can be granted amnesty. He's got no shortage of candidates. Russia has 110,000 people serving time for, quote, economic crimes, unquote, and at least 1 in 10 prisoners. So they've got it. Now, think about it. I mean, the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any civilized country, if not any country at all, maybe in the world. I mean, it's disgusting what we do in the U.S. Our prison system has become a whole government program, and a whole bunch of people in private enterprise are benefiting from building prisons. I think there's an IPO and a fund you can invest in to finance prisons. God, don't do that. We're becoming a police state. I mean, it's just absurd here. We've made everything a law, and we've made everything a reason to put someone in jail here. It's ridiculous. But maybe if things get bad enough in America, Obama will scour the prisons for all the talented people who happen to smoke a joint, and they put him in jail for it. This is absurdity.
Yeah, they had to reach pretty deep into the bullpen here. You know, and what's funny, the article talks about how the Russian police are under pressure to make arrests, and they a lot of times take bribes from businesses to arrest their competitors.
Oh my God, can you imagine how corrupt?
Oh, I love America.
That's so scary. Yeah, this is probably coming to the U.S. soon. it's just unbelievable.
Yep. So you don't live in Russia, you know. Well, for the few of you that do, don't make your competitors very mad. You could end up in the gulag.
Yeah, that's a scary thought. Well, hey, we've got our little, several people have signed up, so thank you. We only announced it on the last episode a few days ago, but we've got our executive Austin property tour coming up. And what executive means, it's an abbreviated version of the tour. No Creating Wealth seminar, but I will be there. So of course we'll have discussions over a couple of meals, and you can ask me questions and so forth, and I'll be talking to you, you know, as we're touring around. But this is limited to just 20 people. It's a small tour. It's a get in and get out quick. If you don't have much time, this is the perfect kind of tour. We've never done these, this new thing we're calling the executive tour. No seminar. You just come in. We'll start at 9 a.m. on Saturday. And what's the date, Steve? The 28th, I think, of September?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, September 28th, and then we'll tour Austin. We'll be done at about, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock that day, and you'll be able to buy properties on the tour, and it's just such a great city. I've thought about moving there many, many times. Really just an awesome city, and I'm so glad that we actually have product that works there. So join us for that. Sign up at jasonhartman.com. And if you become a member for just $120 a year, you get half your membership fee back as your tour discount. So go to jasonhartman.com, become a member of our inner circle, and you get a whole bunch of benefits for that: our monthly conference call, discounts on products, discounts on this tour. You get 20% off, so you save $60 on the tour, basically. So you get half your membership paid for right there. So join us for that, and we'd love to see you there. Remember, the space is limited. It's a small executive tour, so it's just 20 people. Our normal tours have 40, 50 people on them. So this will be a small, quick tour. And then, Steve, two properties real quickly before we get to our guest.
two properties, one here in the Austin, Texas area. Great looking property, built in 2005. And it's your total cash invested, if you use financing, would be about $40,000. You get to 7% cash on cash on this thing. And what I like about it, Jason, you'll get to $64 a square foot, which I think is a very good deal in Austin.
Well, considering that property was only built in 2005, it's almost new. $64 a foot, you're buying below the cost of construction, and you're buying in Austin. Now, remember one thing about Austin that makes it good for investors, although philosophically, I don't like these policies, and I talked about it extensively with Thomas Sewell on the show, and when we had him on, you mentioned him in this episode, Steve, but Austin has a pretty strong environmental movement, so there is some limitations on development there, and that makes it more expensive to build. So once you own, it's like the old riddle, you know, what do you call a developer? Someone who wants to build a house. Well, what do you call an environmentalist? Someone who already owns a house, you know, because they don't want anyone to build there, right?
And that's so, exactly right.
So it's the same idea. So you have a little of that pressure in Austin, which is actually good once you're an owner. So yeah, $64 a foot, incredible deal. Overall return on investment there projected at 26% annually. Even if it only goes half as well, 13% annually, my famous saying. What's the next one, Steve?
I've got one here in Indy, and I have some inside information on it, and that's why I wanted to feature it.
Indianapolis, okay.
This one is a $99,000 property, and it brings an 11% cash on cash, 41% total return. It's only $48 a square foot. It's a little bit older property, but here's what's great about it. This might not mean a lot to most people, but it's in Washington Township. I actually have done a ton of properties in Indianapolis. I've never done a property in Washington Township because it's too expensive. It's the older, more established part of town on the north side. It's where all the old money is, good school districts, very solid area. And I think this property is a very good deal at $48 a square foot there. It's going to rent, you know, like clockwork every time because people want to be in this school district. And it's the first property I've ever seen available in Washington Township.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. Okay, good. Did you give all the stats on that? I don't think so. So
you're
projected,
so.
Let's look at the projection. So $223 a month cash flow projection, that's almost $2,700 per year. And your cash on cash return at 11% annually, and your overall return on investment projected at 41% annually. And again, in all our performers, we have the vacancy rate, maintenance cost, management fees. It's all in there, okay? And you can see these at jasonhartman.com. Click on the properties tab, and you can look at these performers in detail yourself.
Yep, and for the record, this one already has a tenant.
Yeah.
And they're at $1,175 a month.
Pre-rented. Hey, fantastic. Well, Steve, thanks for coming on. Let's get to our guest. We did a long intro as usual today. We'll be back with Les Leopold in just a moment. It's my pleasure to welcome Les Leopold back to the show. I had him on a couple of years ago, and he is out with a new book, and I got to tell you, I love the title. It's entitled, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Got Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Les, welcome back. How are you?
Fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Good, good. And I always like to give the listeners a sense of geography. Where are you located today?
Right now, we're talking to you from a little town called Montclair, New Jersey. We're about 12 miles from dead center Manhattan, New York.
Fantastic. Well, that's where a lot of financial crime takes place, right there in good old New York and the Big Apple.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this book. I mean, haven't hedge funds made the rich a lot richer? You're saying they're siphoning off wealth? Tell us more.
Well, first of all, I got into this because I saw an amazing statistic, which was that after the economic crisis, while we were in the deep, deep recession in 2010, the top hedge fund guy made as much in 1 hour as the average family makes in 47 years. Think about that. 1 hour equals 47 years. So I got very curious about how is this possible? First of all, what is a hedge fund? And how could somebody who runs one make that much money? The next thing, the next factoid that I discovered was that hedge fund made as much profit in that year and with under 100 employees as Apple Computer, which has 700,000 employees and contractors around the world. So I thought, now here's a puzzle. We need to understand this, because the obvious questions come up. What are they? What do they do? But the real question is, do they produce economic value commensurate to the money that they receive? And that became the question that drove the book. How do they, what are they, how do they do it, and are they creating real value for our economy? And that took me on a heck of a ride.
Yeah, well, tell us more about it. I mean, I remember reading an article years ago talking about how the 2 in 20 formula that is known throughout the world of hedge funds, where they charge you a 2% fee every year on your amount of money invested. So if you know, these hedge funds usually have big minimums, so they tend to skew toward wealthier people as investors, but maybe a $250,000 minimum would be sort of the typical hedge fund, I don't know. But they'll charge you 2% annually of the amount of your principal that's invested, plus they'll charge you 20% of any money they make. So it was strange, because this article list did this analysis of that 2 in 20 formula, showing how you could actually lose a whole bunch of money investing with a hedge fund. Now, of course, and I just can't remember how it presented it. It was sort of complex, but you can certainly lose your principal. That's not a big revelation to anybody. But just by the formula that, like, it's like the fund could make money, but you could actually keep losing money as the fund made money somehow, the way that formula was computed. But go wherever you want with it in terms of how it's siphoning off wealth.
Let's take a walk through that.
Yeah.
Okay. You've given us a good introduction. So a hedge fund's an investment vehicle, primarily for the wealthy and for large institutions. You need at least $1 million in net worth to be permitted to be to invest in a hedge fund, or an income, I think, over $250,000. So it's supposed to be for sophisticated investors only. So the way it's sold is like you're going to get entrance at this very high-rolling poker table at the exclusive Vegas casino. So it's going to be, you know, just the wealthy playing against the wealthy. And the smart players are going to win a lot of money for you. So you got to find the right hedge fund. There's about 8,000 of them, 9,000 of them. It's about $1 trillion invested in this. So this is a high-rolling game that you're getting into, but a high-stakes game. But in fact, that's not really how it works. What happens is hedge funds have their own strategies for making money. And many of those strategies, the rest of us would call cheating. Some of them are legal. Some of them are barely legal. And many of them are outright illegal. Let me share with you one, the one that led to this guy making, it turned out to be $2.4 million an hour. His strategy was something, when I found this out, I couldn't believe it. And by the way, I found this out after I wrote the last book. So I was naive when I wrote the last book. I couldn't believe this was going on. Here's what happened. This hedge fund colluded with, not one hedge fund, many hedge funds did this. They colluded with the large banks who had too many toxic-related securities, mortgage securities on their books, and they wanted to get rid of them. So they packaged them together and sold them off. That was, we all know that happened. But what the hedge funds did is they helped the big banks create a security that was designed to fail. They found the worst mortgages they could find, the ones in Vegas, no offense, the ones in Arizona, the ones in Florida that were put out by the most unscrupulous mortgage brokers. They found those mortgage pools, put them together, sold them like they were good as gold, and then bet against them. Now think about that. It's like if I was a pharmaceutical manufacturer, I design a drug, I sell it to you so it will kill you so that I can collect the life insurance. That's precisely what they did, and that was a there's one particular version of this called the Abacus deal between Goldman Sachs and this one hedge fund that the government there was actually a joint committee. Democrats and Republicans agreed on these findings. They analyzed that one in particular, and they found that $1 billion changed hands. These three large institutions lost $1 billion, and the hedge fund guy won $1 billion by designing a security so that it would fail. Now, the SEC came in and fined Goldman Sachs $550 million for not disclosing what was going on here. Guess what they fined the hedge fund?
How much?
Zero.
Zero. How convenient.
Because it was not the hedge fund guy's responsibility to sell the security. So that's how they made $1 billion. Now, where did that money ultimately come from? it ultimately came from those institutions, and from them it came from the people who invested in those institutions. But most importantly, it came from all of us because it was one of the reasons that the housing bubble inflated and then burst. They used this to keep pumping a lot of toxic mortgages into the system. And once it started bursting, this accelerated the crash. So this was an incredibly harmful activity. So not only did it not create any value, but it created negative value. So that's just one of about six or seven eye-popping strategies that I came up with in putting this book together. And I'd be glad to give you some more.
Yeah. Les, I mean, you know, a hedge fund, there's so many misnomers about that phrase. What is a hedge fund exactly? But maybe just tell people what it is, what it was originally meant to be, what it's become.
Sure.
And also, how do you start one? Can anybody start a hedge fund?
Good question.
My dog was planning to start a hedge fund.
Well, originally they were set up as a hedge. It was a way a guy in the 60s invented a way to basically, using financial techniques, he could sort of take the ups and downs of the market out of play so that you would just be betting on the direction of a particular stock or set of stocks. So it was a hedge against the vicissitudes of the market, the ups and downs of the market. It was no big deal. What it later became was almost a license to steal. It was a way to make super, super returns that nobody else could possibly do by taking enormous risks. But also, the key was that these guys don't want to take risks. They try to find sure bets. They try to find rigged bets. They try to find bets that where they cannot lose, where they know the outcome before they go on. I don't know specifically what it takes to set up a hedge fund. You know, you need a certain amount of money. There's certain rules that you have to apply for. But, if you can get $20, $30 million together, you too can start a hedge fund. But the key thing are those rigged bets. There's a reason why 70 hedge fund traders have already been convicted in the last couple of years for insider trading. Because if you know information that everybody else does not know, you can't lose in making your market bets. So insider trading, they put away a billionaire hedge fund guy, Raj Ramanathan, he had a whole ring of people who were giving him insider trading tips. They were sat on boards of directors, and they would call him up moments after an important decision was made that hadn't been announced. He'd get that information. He'd buy the stock or sell the stock according to the information. And then he would make, in one instance, in a matter of minutes, he made $900,000. Overall, they found $65 million worth of instances where he made money this way.
But Les, didn't anybody tell him that the only people that are allowed to do insider trading are members of Congress? What was he thinking?
He was in a different world. They don't make enough money.
Yeah, right.
But another telling, people might say, well, God, you're exaggerating. They can't all be thieves. And maybe they're not. But one very credible source I find is Jim Cramer from Mad Money on CNBC.
Sure, yeah.
He ran a hedge fund for 10 years.
And he bragged about violating SEC regulations and talked about how stupid the SEC was.
Absolutely.
You've probably seen that video. It's unbelievable.
Well, I wrote a whole chapter on him based on his earlier book and that video. He made, on average, for 10 years, 23% return every year. And how did he do that? And he used a variety of techniques that were clearly illegal, and he admitted that they were illegal in terms of the way he was manipulating markets. But the one that got me the most was, at the time he was running his hedge fund, he also was a commentator on CNBC. They loved him because here was a guy who was from Wall Street coming to talk to him. And what he did was he planted false leads with his colleagues, who then would report it as news, and then that would make his bet have his horse win. So in other words, he would rig the news to help his bets. He would literally manipulate his colleagues, the people sitting right next to him on some of these shows, by afterwards telling them, I think such and such is going to happen. You can use me as deep background, but don't use my name, blah, 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 blah. They would try to check it out, and they would report it. That's called rumor mongering, totally illegal, obviously unethical. It's amazing that he admitted. He even mentioned the names of the people that he manipulated. But most importantly, in that interview that you saw on the web, which, by the way, you can't see anymore. You can find the transcript, but they took it off the web, off of YouTube. he says, if you're not willing to do these things, maybe you shouldn't be in the game.
Unbelievable.
In other words, he's saying, I did it. Everybody does it. That's what he's telling us. Everybody does this. Otherwise, you couldn't possibly survive in this game. So they developed their niche that would allow them to bet on a race by knowing who's going to win before they make their bet. One way or another, that's what they are about. Now, I'm not saying every hedge fund does that, but it's remarkable how many are under investigation for doing some version of this. Like, some of it's legal. Like, high-frequency trading is legal, but there's about, I don't know, $120 billion wrapped up in this game. They make from $5 to $20 billion a year. And this is mind-boggling. They set up these incredibly expensive, you know, state-of-the-art computers right next to the stock exchanges. So they get the feed in nanoseconds. And they have these automated programs that can basically work in a parallel universe to you. So when you make your trade on E-Trade, they're able to see what you're doing, buy the stock ahead of you, and sell it back to you for a few pennies more before your trade goes through.
Unbelievable. Yeah, and people actually think they can beat these guys who think that the speed of light is too slow. They need to literally be 186,000 miles per second is not fast enough in the game of high-frequency trading. That's why they pay exorbitant lease prices to landlords to be right next to the exchanges. And they are completely outstripping the profits from the average investors who think that they can actually trade and make money. It's a joke. It's unbelievable. The whole game is so rigged.
Catch this. One of these guys admitted that in the last 5 years, he hadn't had a losing day. And the longest he ever held a stock, for him, a long-term hold, was 2 seconds.
God, that's insane.
Now, what value does that produce for the American economy? As far as I can tell, this is the equivalent of a hidden tax. Which is why I advocate a financial transaction tax, which is why should these guys be collecting a tax on everybody's transactions? Instead, if we had a small financial transaction tax, it would more or less wipe out the high-frequency traders, and it would generate enough money to send every kid that wants to go to a public college and university in this country, two-year, four-year, whatever, they could go tuition-free. That's how much we could generate from financial transaction tax.
The only part I don't agree with you is if you let the government have the tax, they'll figure out a way to waste it and make the monster bigger and worse
I would do it in a trust fund. I wouldn't let that happen.
Yeah, but you know.
Because look, what's the most important thing you got to do in this? Right now, kids have over $1 trillion worth of debt, right? It's one of the biggest things.
Yeah. Oh, no. The student loan debt bubble is huge. And the other thing to know about that is that's such a scam, too, Les, because you can't declare bankruptcy and get out of it. You never get a second chance.
Right. So I'm saying set up a trust fund for public education in this country. God knows that to be an adequate seed to have a college education, just about to get a decent job, you need to have a college education. Why not make it the equivalent of high school now, truly? So here's a way to pay for it. Set up a trust fund and have the people who crashed the economy for us finally pay their dues.
Well, that's a whole tangential thing, but you know, as to how to solve the problem. But at least let's bring awareness to the problem, okay? So a couple things in the book, How to Make $1 million an Hour, I want to ask you about, okay? So one chapter is entitled, Rip Off Entire Countries Because That's Where the Money Is. Are you referring to Iceland there?
No, actually, the one I was referring to was the first big hedge fund play. First $1 billion play was George Soros's raid on the Bank of England.
Oh, yes. Good point. Yes. Soros's ill-gotten gains, just like the Kennedy family's origination. I've had Jim Rogers, his former business partner, on the show a couple of times. But yeah, tell us about Soros.
Well, Soros is an iconic trade. And the reason it's iconic is because a lot's been written about it as well that justifies it. And basically what happened was, as they were trying to put together the European Union, the exchange rates of the various currencies were supposed to be held within a certain band. And it was pretty clear that, or Soros' people recognized, that England was going to have a tough time after the Berlin Wall fell and Germany's was worried about inflation. England was going to have a tough time keeping the pound within the range, and it was likely to be devalued. But they didn't want to devalue it because they'd have to... if they raised interest rates, if they devalued it, they'd be violating the treaty. And if they raise interest rates to keep it there, it would hurt all the homeowners in England and create a recession because their mortgages are tied to the Bank of England's interest rate. So they were kind of stuck. The Soros' people saw that, so they shorted. They bet against the pound massively. And then other banks in the United States joined in. So they created this artificial run on the pound. And finally, England caved in, and Soros made $1 billion. And the money came directly from the taxpayers of England into Soros' pocket. Now, the irony, of course, is that Soros says that he'd be glad to stop his currency speculation once there was a European Union, because as a refugee from the Holocaust, he understood that it was good to get the countries, you know, especially France and Germany and England, tied closely together economically so they'd never go to war again against each other. And that was a wonderful sentiment. The irony, of course, is that the same thing is happening now, but instead of going after currencies, now they're going after the debts of various countries, and they have the and banks. So they have the equivalent of the same kind of thing. They can gang up on a bank. They then put out some false rumors about, they were doing this to various banks. And then as people start taking the money out of the bank, the value of the bank declines, and they make a bundle. They did the same thing with Greek bonds and other entities. So wherever you see trouble in Europe, you can be sure there's piles of hedge funds trying to make it worse. And Soros was the person who taught everybody, look, you don't have to just bet. You can bet so big that you actually determine the outcome. That was the Soros' secret, and they're still doing it.
Amazing stuff, what happens at the highest levels of finance. You know, I think you alluded to this earlier, but step 9, as you talk about in the book, is about betting on the race after you already know who wins. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think in a sense that that's almost generic for what happens. It's wrong to view hedge funds and Wall Street in general as casinos. You know, we like to use that term. You don't risk billions of dollars like you're betting in a casino. You want the bet rigged. So the whole series of things that we've been talking about are yet another version of that. So you know the outcome when you do high frequency trading, because you're working so quickly you can actually see it before it happens. You know the outcome when you're designing a security that's designed to fail and you're betting against it. You know the outcome when you're placing rumors, you know, false rumors to your colleagues at CNBC. You know the outcome when you have insider trading. Each one of these is the antithesis of gambling. When you corner a market a la Soros, you know the outcome before you do it. So that's the key to successful hedge fund strategies. I used to think it was just that they had great models predicting the future of how the stocks and bonds would move. No, it's trying to figure out the end of the horse race who's going to win the horse race before it ends, and knowing that for a certainty. Otherwise, why are you going to risk billions of dollars? You just wouldn't.
Well, see, I think that it is a casino for all the traditional investors, the regular
investors. Yeah, for the rest of
it. Yeah, right. But for the big wigs, it is a rigged game. It's funny that people defend Wall Street as though it's this capitalist tool that's this great thing that is a free market and these big players should be defended because you're attacking business. No, you're not attacking business. You're attacking fascism. These businesses are so embedded in the system that they control outcomes. It's not like it's a free market capitalist system, as people may think. It's just not that way anymore. It may have been that way at one time, but it's not that way anymore. Okay. How do they claim that limits on speculation will kill jobs? That's another way that they
mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's another way they create this like fascist system that they get the government on their side to do their schemes, right?
Not just on their side. They got a tax break. They have their own special tax break called carried interest. That 20% you talked about that they get of the profits?
The 2 and 20.
The 2 and 20. The 2 is taxed at the regular marginal tax rate. So that's 39% now for these guys in their income bracket. The 20 is taxed as capital gains, 20%. So they're paying half as much, most of their profits that they get, the lion's share, 90% of the money that they're earning. This is the money they're earning, right, from their supposed investment strategies. This is their fee. They don't pay it as income. And so that's a special tax privilege. So the people who support that tax privilege claim that if you took that tax privilege away, it would cost American jobs. And that is the most ridiculous argument I ever heard anybody make. But they make it with a straight face. And guess what? Both Democrats and Republicans have made that claim. Even liberal Democrats have made that claim. And that's because they are scared to death. They can't think out. They don't want to mess with the hedge funds. There's too much money there. And in fact, there's another issue that I think is you touched upon something before that I think is absolutely essential, which is we have an oligopoly of finance now, and I don't think you can have free market capitalism and a financial oligopoly at the same time. And so the people who really care about free market capitalism, they should be up in arms about what's going on Wall Street right now. That's one point I think that you were getting me to think about by your last comment.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah.
The other one is the problem is we equate wealth with economic value without even asking. So if somebody's rich, they must be smart. They must be producing something valuable in the market or they wouldn't have gotten rich in the first place. And it becomes a tautology. So these hedge fund guys are looked up to like they're geniuses, that they're just really super smart investors. All this negative stuff I'm talking about, people pay no attention to that in the highest circles. So because they have a lot of money, they are considered, it's a prima facie kind of case, right, for being so high valued.
Right.
Now,
By the way, I want to just mention something on that. I think that is generally true in the world of real things. The problem is this is a world of smoke and mirrors. There's no real value necessarily being created. I mean, there may be occasionally, maybe a fund funds an investment and the investment does good for the world, like farmland that provides food or something like that. I mean, that certainly happens, but by and large, a lot of these, they're just making money by moving things around and manipulating them. And it's a game of smoke and mirrors. This is like what I call this, the smoke and mirrors economy versus the real economy. The real economy deals in real goods and services. These aren't goods and services most
exactly.
of the time.
A way to make a clear-cut comparison is we've forgotten what a bank really is or what an investment vehicle really is. And you just described it. It's supposed to take our savings, and then they're supposed to transform savings into investment. A community bank will take in people's deposits and then loan it out to businesses in the form of mortgages or in the form of investments in businesses. And that's what perpetuates economic development, and we need it. Bank of North Dakota does that, a public bank, and does it well. When banking and investment became a hedge fund inside a bank is called the proprietary trading desk, and outside it's called a hedge fund. But basically, it becomes a vehicle to extract profits from everybody else. They don't care about what it's invested in anymore. They care in terms of doing real investment in the economy. It's money that they're not investing in the real economy. It's money that they're putting in and out of markets to gain advantage and to basically siphon off the general capital of the economy as a whole. And this is something that we virtually put a stop to during the Great Depression, and it basically didn't happen all the way from the 1930s up to about 1980.
What are the real changes? I mean, you're probably going to say Glass-Steagall was one of them, but please outline how it changed back in a bad way, in a negative way.
Yes. Okay. What happened was virtually every form of deregulation set in. So one of them you mentioned was the allowing. It used to be that investment banking and this what we'll call gambling, although it's not really gambling, but that kind of speculative stuff was in one kind of bank. And our insured deposits were in another kind of bank. So that meant that if they lost their money and they went under, it wouldn't affect the taxpayer. Well, that changed. We got rid of Glass-Steagall, and they basically could commingle the institutions. And, of course, we saw how well that worked out. That was just one of many. These fancy instruments, like the ones that were designed to fail, these mortgage pooled securities, are called derivatives. And I try to take people through that very carefully in the book, how that works. But they were deregulated. So what happened was that they could bet on anything. Look, for example, in housing, you cannot take out a insurance policy on your neighbor's house. They figured out 800 years ago that if you did so, that house was likely, it was likely to burn down.
Right. It's a conflict of interest. Yeah, obviously.
Right. You may not prove who did it or how it happened. Well, we allow that to happen all over finance now, to the tune of hundreds of trillions of dollars of bets are taking place, and it's not regulated. So if something goes wrong, it goes wrong really big time, and that was a major contributor to the financial crash. Simple things like credit card interest rates were deregulated. The savings and loan industry was deregulated until that obviously totally imploded and wiped out saving institutions as we know it. The idea of letting banks get bigger and bigger, we threw out antitrust regulations on banks. Right now, the top five banks have 60% of all the banking in the country.
Well, yeah, but what really is the antitrust rule? I mean, if Bank of America tried to buy, not that they'd be suitable, but, you know, or say Citibank, tried to buy B of A and Wells and Chase, right? That would be something I would consider a monopoly. But, I mean, you do have choice. We're not at an antitrust point yet, are we? I mean, I agree that the banks are too big and they're too big to fail.
So far beyond it. Oh, my God. Because, look, there are so few banks that they literally can rig all the basic interest rates. So the LIBOR scandal.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
Right. Sure. There's 15 big banks that set that rate. So they got together and colluded because there's only 15 banks. International banks. It's easy to do it. I think there's 19 systemically important financial institutions now in the United States. Their mortgage rates, as low as they are, they're higher than they should be. They're getting money at zero from the federal government, and they're loaning it out at a rate that if it was a truly competitive marketplace, if there were many, many institutions doing it, one could argue they would be lower. It's just harder to cheat when you have more institutions competing for the business. Big, size matters. And the argument always was, well, maybe they're big in this country, but that's what you need internationally in order to compete with other banks. You need giant banks to go along with giant corporations. And I think they're definitely oligopoly problems. But I think there's a bigger problem. The bigger problem is that this is weird to say, but I'm not sure if private enterprise works in high finance anymore. I think the model, it's very interesting that North Dakota, one of the most conservative states on the planet, has a publicly owned bank and that it's thriving. It's a wholesale bank, so it's more like a Wall Street bank, except it's much smaller. Most people don't know this, but
considering, there was even a bill in North Dakota last year. Now, keep in mind, though, North Dakota is a rich state. You know, it's got all that oil, okay? So it's a little bit different.
It hasn't been all that rich since 1919.
Fair enough.
Part of the bank.
Fair enough. But the other thing is, you know, they actually had a bill to eliminate property taxes there, which I think property taxes are a ridiculous concept. You pay taxes on the money to buy the property, and then you buy it, but you never really actually own it because there's a perpetual lien against the property through taxes, which just encourages people never to pay off mortgages because they can't really own it free and clear. So, again, it's the government creating malinvestment, but it didn't pass in North Dakota, so you still do have property taxes. But it was just interesting that state is well-managed enough to have that possibility.
The top bank officers of that public bank average about $130,000 a year.
You mean they don't get like $70 million a year?
Right. They get less than the chauffeurs for the Wall Street banks get, less than the cooks that the Wall Street banks get. Imagine, here's the other thing. Right now, when you pay your taxes or you pay a hunting license or a fishing license, where does the money go? Most people think it goes to some vault in the in the state capital of Phoenix or wherever. No, it goes to a large bank, usually a Wall Street bank, because they're the only ones that are large enough to handle what the state needs for cash management. That's $1 trillion a year that of our tax money that goes to Wall Street banks, except the one place it doesn't happen is in North Dakota. The tax money and fees go to the Bank of North Dakota. If we had 50 state banks, we'd be taking $1 trillion out of Wall Street. We also could replace Wall Street's control of the Federal Reserve. Those 50 banks could sit on the Federal Reserve boards instead of the Wall Street banks and their representatives. That would change the ballgame as well. That would be the beginnings of a financial system that would matter, because then you'd be moving power away from the gambling institutions and moving it towards real banking. And these state banks, by the way, don't compete with the community banks. They support them. So there's 80 community banks in North Dakota supported by the partnerships with the Bank of North Dakota, the wholesale bank. There's a great group out in California called the Public Banking Institute. I'm not sure when this is going to be aired, but they're having a conference on June 3rd and 4th, or 2nd, 3rd, 4th in California. People should check them out. They're very, very smart people who I think are raising some important questions that we all need to look at.
Well, Les, give out your website and tell people where they can get the books.
Okay. It's How to Make $1 Million an Hour. People can get it. They should be able to get it at any bookstore. They can get it from Powell's on the internet, or from Barnes & Noble, or from Amazon.
And by the way, on Amazon, 4.5 stars. 4.5 stars.
Doing okay.
Good reviews.
Doing
yeah,
okay.
Doing well.
I thank everybody for that. And right now, my website at my company is under construction, but you can find me if you go to Alternet. If you go Les Leopold Alternet, or if you go Les Leopold Huffington Post, you'll see a list of a lot of my articles that I've been writing in the last couple years.
Well, hey, Les, just wrap it all up with a quick closing thought, if you would.
My closing thought is this. We have to understand this stuff. We can't leave it to experts. If we want to be citizens in this country, we're going to have to understand something about high finance. We have to know how hedge funds work. And I'm encouraging everybody, not necessarily through me, but go out there and get yourself an education on this, because it really matters.
Good stuff. It certainly does. Les Leopold, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Do you need a second opinion? No problem. Let Jason's experts evaluate the deal. Our deal evaluator is only $50. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com now. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.